ranks. Chief of Staff Edward Mayhew, who also happened to be John's eldest brother, and Executive Office Manager Churlgrove Findlay Norris. Between his two governmental bases and the office that looked after his investment and property portfolio, John had more staff than the POTUS, although there was an opening for a girl Friday, London, now, since his last one was currently enjoying her 15 minutes of fame. The people of breakfast and daytime TV, and every programme which attracted those the media chose to concentrate its temporary but brightest lights on, were no doubt already negotiating appearance fees with her people. Why was it always someone in that junior assistant slash intern slash researcher role who toppled the boss, thought Sophie? Weren't there enough cautionary tales of littered corpses to warn any man in a high-profile position, who really should know better, what dark and treacherous waters he elected to dip into when he chose a pretty young, ambitious swimming companion? A pond with 100 signs around it, all lit up with massive red neon lettering and strings of exclamation marks. Warning! Danger! Come any closer and you're a bloody idiot! It would have been easy for the other woman to fall in love with her husband, though, if that were what it was. John could sell ice to the Eskimos, coal to Newcastle, toys to Santa and all the other clichés. Charm personified, absurdly handsome, moneyed, intelligent, refined. Oh yes, John F. Mayhew was the full package. Sophie could guess how quickly Rebecca Robinson would have become ensnared in his net, even thrown herself into it willingly, because she had done the same thing 14 years ago, when she was 18. She'd met him at the Christmas ball when she was in her first year at Cambridge University, studying French, and he was in his last year studying business and politics. He'd been absolutely wrecked on champagne and told her he was going to marry her before his friends dragged him off for yet more alcohol. She didn't think much about it until Valentine's Day, when their paths collided again at a private party. She spotted him long before he noticed her, which gave her the luxury of studying him unseen. He wasn't her dream type at all, but he was extremely magnetic, and from the way he held himself, it was more than obvious he knew what his best qualities were. Long-limbed and lean, she imagined him as a human equivalent of a well-bred racehorse, something pampered and valued. Greek statue profile, mid-brown hair that flopped into his eyes, and what eyes they were. Puppy brown, intense, seductive. Eventually, as if detecting the heat in her gaze, his eyes swept around to hers, locked, and she felt powerless, as if she were a hen and he a fox. He sliced through the banks of students that stood between them, mouth stretching into a killer smile, and when he reached her said, "Well, if it isn't you again, where have you been hiding yourself?" And from that moment, they were a couple. Sophie forgot all about swooning over the prop forward who was on her course, which was a shame because he would end up captaining England and was a thoroughly nice chap. But John F. Mayhew engulfed her brain and was all she could think about. John F. was going to be richer than Croesus and Prime Minister one day, he said, and she didn't doubt that he would be. She could easily forecast his future. Top of the tree in his chosen profession. Women would adore him, men would want to be him, magazine reporters would queue up outside his door to take photos of the beautiful home he lived in. His children would be perfect and well-behaved. Maybe they'd be her children too. Maybe this was the man that her old headmistress, Miss Palmer Price, told her would be the one to carry her along in the grip of his force field. The F stood for Fitzroy, he told her post-coitus in bed on the night he took her virginity. His great-great-great-grandfather, Donald F. Mayhew, and his best friend Patrick had decided to escape the Great Irish Famine by emigrating to America in the late 1840s, but an Irish heiress fell hook, line and sinker for the strong and handsome, if impoverished, gypsy Donald, and he changed his mind about going. Donald and his wife eventually moved to London, where his determination both to shake off the label of male gold digger and to better himself drove him to build up a fortune in his own right, selling property, metal, alcohol, ship parts, anything legal or illegal to trade in order to make a profit.